Good evening. This is Marilee Krieger, your Tacoma Public Library Book Notes reporter. And tonight I have a real treat in store for you, especially for those of you that have lived in Tacoma for any length of time or who have lived in Tacoma long enough to have read some of the novels and stories that take place in Tacoma. Our guest this evening is going to introduce herself. Would you tell us who you are?
I am Elizabeth Sale. I was born Betty Sale Clemens in Bloomington, Indiana on June 26, 1886. I came to Tacoma with my parents when I was 3 years old, grew up here, married here, and my two sons were born here. I have written poems, stories, novels, and radio material, and have been poetry editor of a well-known magazine. My novels, Recitation from Memory, and My Mother Bids Me Bind My Hair, have a Tacoma setting. A recent publication is a collection of lyrics called The Field. I will read some short poems published within the last few years in magazines, newspapers, and anthologies. First, Heritage. Great-great-grandpa Peter Clemens founded Clemens, North Carolina, raised a house of hand-hewn timbers, many chambers, many chimneys. Built a bridge across the Yadkin, reared four sons and nine sweet daughters, had one wife, good comfort Costin. Great-great-grandpa Peter Clemens wrote a book to guide his children, named himself Poor Peter, pleading that his offspring hearken to him, gave advice to wives and daughters, taught them duties to their husbands, cautioned sons on vice and gambling, told of mystic dreams and visions, almost like another Bunyan. Preached and called his townsmen to him, to his big house, spouted dogma, stood alone in 1780, damning slavery, shouting bravely, "No man has a right, my neighbors, right to own another human." Great-great-grandpa Peter Clemens willed his comfort and his children, lands and houses, gold and silver, horses, cows, and sheep and poultry, feather beds and sheets of linen, knives and forks and china dishes. Down to me through generations came his book, Poor Peter Calling, to his stranger great-great-grandchild, speaking quaintly, still humanely, to a distant, hearkening offspring.
Great-great-grandpa Peter Clemens?
Yes.
And that was the poem called Heritage.
Heritage from the Lyric magazine.
Uh-huh. And now what else do you have
for us? This is called Daisy, and this is free verse, and it won a prize as the best poem in any California newspaper 1 year lately. Witnesses said that just before the truck carrying the nags to the slaughterhouse crashed in a fiery explosion in the highway's ditch, an old white mare at the tailboard had stretched her neck far out, sniffed the air, and neighed a long nostalgic neigh as if she knew she was near home. In the excitement, rescuing the driver, horrified by burning horse's screams, no one had noticed her as she leapt to the pavement and, ignoring bleeding knees, limped toward a bushy opening off the road, nosed into it, and felt the soft moss of an old trail beneath her unshod feet. There it was, the remembered house, before which she had so often waited between buggy shafts, windowless, leaning its fences down. She ambled to her parched pasture lot, fenceless too, rolled in the foxtails, savored clumps of sweet grass near a sluggish stream, once a brook, stood listening for vanished children's voices calling, "Daisy, Daisy, Daisy," smiled a snaggled yellow smile, sly, gratified. Ah, no one in all that raucous, brutal city had known the junk man's horse was named Daisy. Then, when the sun reddened behind the ridgepole of a dilapidated barn, she found her way through its gaping door to a familiar stall, snuffled the empty manger, let her head droop, her eyes close, dreamed of the little foal she had dropped on that rotting floor, bent her stiff legs, lay down, and slept.
And that's Daisy.
Yes.
That's one of the poems that has won a prize for you, and you have won many prizes through the years, haven't you, Miss Sale, for your
yes,
poetry?
Yes, lately I seem to have had quite a good many prizes and awards.
Well, that's wonderful. And you've edited magazines,
poetry magazines. Rob Wagner's Script as the poetry editor for 10 years.
Oh, for goodness
sake. Of Beverly Hills.
Well, you certainly have done a lot of work on your own poetry and then have edited other poets'
yes,
work as well.
Yes, and lately, over the last 10 years or so, I have worked with a lot of young writers to help them all I can, especially with no knowledge of publishers or publication problems, and I know plenty about that.
And that is a thing that many young writers, when they start out, just are not prepared to cope with.
No, they certainly are not. They don't know the ropes at all.
Do you have another poem for us, Miss Sale?
Well, here is one that came from the lyric, too, and it is called To an Old Tune. To an old tune called Light a Love, they rode the merry-go-round. The lad on the bay horse, the girl on the gray, turn after turn on a summer day in the park at Stony Cove. Both caught at the ring. He won, she missed, but it graced her finger when they kissed. Two for a dime for another ride, for catching the ring, one free. A breeze carried music over the tide that came from an inland sea. To an old tune called Light o' Love, dancers upon a screen, bow and promenade and whirl before the eyes of an aged girl, young again in her low wheelchair, again at Stony Cove. Once more she rides the merry-go-round on a gray horse, her lad on a bay, and thinks of a cherished ring of brass and a marriage night on the sweet June grass in the park by the salty sound. He escaped from life on the pale horse death, following the Red Horse War. She was captured by life, and through 80 years have served it in joy, dilemma, and fears, to sit with flickering breath, listening to fiddles play Light o' Love, in memory to ride the merry-go-round on a leaping gray horse, with her lad on a bay horse at her side, in the park at Stony Cove.
I like that one, Miss Sale. I can hear the merry-go-round. I can see the merry-go-round. And I can see the merry-go-round that her 80 years of life has given her, too. We have time, I'm sure, for at least one more poem. Do you have something you particularly like?
Yes, I'd like to read Only One Summer Day, and it also won an award from the Anna Kulbis Circle, the big statewide poetry Society of California. Only one summer day, for afterlife, only one summer day. Make my Elysian field a vacant lot beside my parents' towered jigsawn house. There let me be a child again, and for companion, give me back my lost first son as a little boy. He'll bring my dachshund Franz and all my sadly mourned beloved cats, Buffy and Pansy, Gypsy and Gingersnap, Peepy and Hi-Ho, Silvery and Shy. Gaily we'll romp in milkweed, tansy, sorrel. Playmates together then, my son and I, will weave wreaths of sweet clover, red and white, and braid an acrid collar of dog fennel for patient Franz. He'll hate its pungent smell. We'll find bright bits of glass, amber and blue, for secret troves of imitation gems to hide in meadowlark's abandoned nests. We'll blow old dandelion floss away, to see if my mother wants us. Yes, she will. When shadows cluster at the kitchen door, gold lamp in hand, gilding the honeysuckle, twined on porch railings, she will call us home to bread and milk and love, and a still night of endless sleep beside her, all in one dark, deep bed.
Well, thank you, Miss Sale. And of course, that's the way we know you, as Elizabeth Sale, authoress, novelist, poetess. But you have some other claims for fame, too. One I know you're particularly most willing to talk about, and that's your son. Both your sons.
Well, my older son was a little adopted boy. He was left on our doorstep when my husband and I were about 24 and 25 years old, or perhaps younger. His mother had died, he had no home, so we took him in. He was 2 years old, and we adopted him. And our lawyer said we'd have to make him our legal heir, but we didn't have much to be legal heir to, so we did that. And he was Harry. We gave him our name, Harry Edward Stewart. My first husband's name was James Murdoch Stewart. And we gave him our name, and he really was the smartest child I ever had anything to do with. He could learn anything and learn very fast. And he was 6 years old when my own son was born. And he thought that he was rather an important person in the family, and he always called my son our son, James Murdoch Stewart, Jr. Well, when he was a young man, he got a position as a radio announcer and entertainer on the new radio station KVI in Tacoma. And there he came in contact with a lot of these fake Hindu mystics that used to come to radio, and they all had different dialects and claimed to be Hindus. So he said, you know, it would be fun to do that in Swede dialect and claim to be a Hindu. So he wrote this thing just for fun. And that, of course, took him on to the Al Pierce gang and made him quite famous as Yogi Jorgensen, the great Hindu mystic. Well, of course, he had many other radio and television and motion picture adventures. But finally, one day, he sat down and wrote a song in Swedish dialect called Frida My Clam Digger Sweetheart, which sold 40,000 copies in Astoria alone in 2 weeks. And Capitol Records featured him in about 40 different records, some in Swedish dialect and some in Japanese dialect, in which he was quite expert, too.
He was a man of many talents and many
and
languages.
We very much regret to have to say that he was killed in his car in 1956, and it's been a great loss, not only to the family, but I think to the radio and television and motion picture world, too.
And your other son?
Now, my other son, James Murdoch Stewart, Jr., happened to have a very beautiful voice and acting ability, so he was trained in the Pasadena School of the Theater and was a scholarship pupil of the leading tenor of Metropolitan Opera, whose name also was Clemens, Hans Clemens. And he is a beautiful singer and has been head of music and drama at the famous Chadwick School in the Palos Verdes Hills. And he is really a very happy married man with three beautiful daughters and a beautiful wife.
And he's in California, and
No, dearie, he doesn't. He lives in Colorado now.
Oh, I thought he was.
He lives in Colorado now.
Mm-hmm. You make your home in California.
Yes, I live in Palo Alto, mm-hmm. near Stanford.
And you come up to Tacoma on occasion to
visit
your friends.
I used to come once a year, but things have interfered, so I haven't been here for 5 years, I'm sorry to say.
Well, we certainly are glad that we had a chance to capture you long enough to get you to come in and talk with us and to share some of your poetry that is not in the published book, The Field, mm-hmm. so that we might have this on record, too. Thank you very much, Ms.
Well,
Sale.
I certainly appreciate the honor of being asked.
Thank you very much. This has been Marilee Krieger, your Tacoma Public Library Book Notes reporter. Good night. Miss Sale, we just finished recording a program for KTNT, but we have time left and you have agreed to share some more of your poetry with us. What would you like to read for us now?
Well, this is one that won the Phillida Prize, which is one of the money prizes from the Lyric Magazine, the poetry magazine, every year. It's called The Duster. It's based on an incident in my own family. Great-grandmother paused before the stairs well and called to Phoebe, "Go find Belle. It's time to dust the banister rails. Tell her three times and none of her tales." Belle came giggling through the parlor door, dust rag in hand, "Just like before, three times, Miss Betsy." As she bent, as she rubbed, as she polished there, Belle sang "Climbing the Golden Stair." The mahogany gleamed like a roan mare's hide when she reached the top step and shouted with pride, "First time, Miss Betsy." Down she went, singing and gay, her duster flipping the dust away. She wiped every spindle, smoothed the dark wood, then stood at the bottom step, loud as she could, "Second time, Miss Betsy." Up again to the left, to the right, "Old banister's gonna shine this night." Right rail, left rail, each curly cue. Belle stopped and muttered, "Yes, that'll do. Third time, Miss Betsy." Great-grandmother rustled down the stair, to the left, to the right, flicked everywhere with her tiny lace handkerchief, clean as snow. Then looked up at Belle as she stood below and smiled approval. Belle sped to her, took the little white handkerchief for a look. "As pure as the breast of a sucking dove, the fourth time, Miss Betsy."
Your bit of dialect in that poem reminded me that you did for quite a long time a program of Negro dialect, didn't you?
Oh, I was a star of KOMO, and I had a sponsor, no one else did. And I did this Missouri Jackson broadcast, a short story monologue, a new one every week.
Did you write these yourself?
Oh, I wrote them myself. Sometimes I wrote them on the boat going to Seattle because I hadn't had time to write them before. And they were in the Kentucky Negro dialect, which I had learned from my people and the servants we had in the house. And it became the most popular program as far as KOMO went, I have heard from old timers on the station. And
well, then you did radio work as well as your sons, and it sort of runs in the family.
Oh, yes, and not only that, but I played the mammy role in the first version of Showboat. I wrote three radio plays a week for a station over in Seattle, and then I went to New York and went on radio there in 1928.
Well, that must have been a great experience.
Well, that was a great period for radio.
1928 was a bad time for lots of things, but a good time for radio.
Yes, well, I went to New York and broadcast there and had many experiences. All this time I was writing poetry and working on novels, though. I was doing that, too, because I considered this radio work nothing but just something to do when you didn't have anything else to get at us.
Well, do you have another poem for us?
Well, here is something that I think is probably the best short poem I ever wrote. It's called Undine, and it is on the theme of Undine, the sea nymphs. She calls him across dark water. She calls him with her coot's wail, with her gull's creak, with her seal's bark. She calls him. She seeks him on the floor of the dark water. She walks the moon's path, and her hair of dank brown seaweed trails across the sleet dark water. As she seeks him, she finds him. To the low sill of his window her scales cling, and she sees his white-eyed terror, terror fraught with avid longing. As she finds him, she takes him from his sleeping spouse. She takes him, and her stinging brine kiss stills him as she takes him. She lulls him in her cave beneath dark water, where the eels hide, where the crabs crawl, where the squids dart, in her phosphorescent dwelling underwater, undulantly, gently lulls him as she drowns him.
The sound of the sea and the sea nymph is certainly in that one. Do you have another?
Here is a sonnet. I guess it's not a sonnet either, but it looks like it.
It's the shape of one.
Yeah, turquoise. She took such naive joy in little things, like paste-smeared greeting cards kids made at school. Her birthday fell on Christmas. Memory brings my heart deep, sore regret. Why not a jewel, or a fine fur, or pearls, or glowing strings of amber beads? What stupid rule said mother could not want real gold earrings? She oohed and aahed with genuine delight at gifts of stockings serviceable and warm, drab hug-me-tights and flannel petticoats, or thick galoshes should the weather storm. She thanked us merrily with favorite quotes, receiving bed socks for a chilly night. December, child, too late, I understand. A birthstone gift should grace a wrinkled hand.
That's charming. How do you write
this
your
poem? This is from an anthology put out by the Chaparral Poets of California.
And you have several poems in that one.
Undine is two.
Uh-huh.
And I have one about Puget Sound. Would you like that one?
Yes, I'm fond of Puget Sound.
Between the Dawn and the Sunrise. Now, when I was a little girl, we always camped at Hale's Passage looking toward Fox Island. And at early, early dawn, some reefs would rise up out of the, at low tide, would rise up out of the bottom of the sea. And we always would go over there. So this is called Between the Dawn and the Sunrise. Always at dawn she gazed across the pass that washed her wooded island's sandy shores to see a pointed reef bared by low ebb, piercing the liquid opalescent glass. Launching her black canoe, the Siwash girl shattered the mirror with her paddle's dip. Then from the reef's seaweed and swathed wet ruts gathered small, delicate oysters shelled in pearl. Waiting the sunrise on the depth's sharp peak, she stood, the woven basket on her back, braced by a beaded band, held her boat's line, watched the swift flow approach, the water seek to claim her pinnacle, once more to hide its treasures far beneath the wakened sea, shimmering emeralds until the flame of morning painted it a molten tide.
Miss Sale, can you tell us a little bit about how you write your poetry? Is it a matter of rapid inspiration, or is it sometimes that way, or?
Well, I think a line comes to me, a line that gives me an inspiration. Unfortunately, I usually get these inspirations in the bathtub, and I can't write them down.
Well, I should think that you would have arranged by now to have a pad somehow handy.
But I write them very fast, and then work them over, of course, and work them over and over.
What would be your advice to a young poet starting out now? I know that it's hard to give one piece of advice, but would you tell him it is a good...
If he has no sense of metaphor, he is not a poet. And if he wants to write these prosaic, meaningless word puzzles, as John Gould Fletcher called them, or make gesticulations at himself in a mirror, he is not a poet.
Metaphor is...
A sense of metaphor is the main thing. Of course, I think you have to have a real sense of rhythm, too, appreciation of rhythm.
And appreciation of sound.
And of course you have to know words, mm-hmm. really know the value of words. But that comes along, you work on that. But I'm quite sure the sense of metaphor is just sort of inborn.
To have a sense of metaphor, you would have to have read a lot and to have listened and to have learned.
Fortunately, my father had a classic education, and although he was a Tacoma letter carrier, John S. Clemens, letter carrier number 9, he had to go to work when he was 35 and he spent all his mother's money. And he loved to read to me at night, even when I was, before I started to school. And he read me Tennyson and Byron and Longfellow and The Pilgrim's Progress and The Book of Job. And I'm quite sure that that's what gave me my appreciation of poetry, and it lasted.
Did your sense of humor come from your father, too?
Oh, all Clemenses are terribly funny. I never saw anything like it. My Uncle Junius one time was tying up a horse at our gate, and he looked up at me and said, there never were but two men who could tie up a horse like this, and one of us died.
Well, it takes a sense of humor to appreciate life and to enjoy it as much as I'm sure that you have.
Another thing, too, advice to the young poet, don't take yourself so seriously that you can't laugh at yourself.
That's a good piece of advice for all of us.
That is the true sense of humor.
Yes, indeed. Is there anything else that you can tell us, or another poem that you would like to read for us, Miss Sale? We are taking advantage of you, keeping you here and having you read for us, but we are enjoying it.
Well, this is also in this Chaparral anthology, and it is it won a prize, too. It's called On Reading Herndon's Lincoln. Now, very few of you have read Herndon's Lincoln. He was Herndon's law partner in Illinois for 30 years, and he really knew Lincoln and knew things about Lincoln that nobody else knew. And in his wonderful three-volume biography of Lincoln, he has told things that are usually hidden from us. On Reading Herndon's Lincoln. My kinfolk hated Lincoln all their lives, and many of them mouth about him still. Even today, my old Aunt Mattie strives to change to ones, each hated $5 bill. My Uncle Randolph had a stroke, it's true, ripping and snorting at an article, likening Abe to Christ, and every particle of his hot gorge rose up to flame and spew. But reading of him as he is revealed in this frank book, sad, perhaps unnamed, bereft of love, abused, by chance blood-sealed, to a dark race of slaves, is pitifully maimed. Lincoln, through ugly truth, stands giant size above whitewashing fools or ranters' lies.
Well, Miss Sale, we've concentrated on your poetry. Would you tell us just a little bit about your novels? I know they were based on Tacoma.
Well, I'm one of these unlucky writers, and I don't know of any writer that isn't unlucky. But I wrote a novel called Recitation from Memory, and I sent it to the Atlantic Monthly $10,000 prize in 1942. And in about 3 weeks, I got a letter from one of the judges saying that they had laid it aside for the decision if I would cut it 50,000 words. Well, I just jumped in bed and covered up my head and said, I'm not going to do it. But finally, I looked out, and I went out and took a lot of things out that and fixed up the continuity and sent it back. So one morning, in one of those funny half-dreams and half-awakening spells you have when you hear somebody call your name or the telephone bell ring, a voice said, the judges have awarded you the $10,000 prize. So that woke me up, and I got it, but it was only a few hours later that the postman brought the return manuscript and said, the judges have decided that no prize will be given this year. Explanations to follow. But the letter I got was from one of the judges. And I want that book. I am now the book editor of Dodd Mead, and I want that book for Dodd Mead. So I said to my husband, well, I'll just get on the train and go back to New York. She also wanted to cut 10,000 words more.
Oh, dear.
And I knew this would just be going back and forth and back and forth, so I went back to New York. And then she told me, that the judges, including Mr. Ellery Sedgwick, had awarded me this prize. And then three men came over from the commercial department of Little Brown, and Little Brown published for the Atlantic Monthly. And they thought it wouldn't make a bestseller, and who in the dickens was this Betty Sale, and where was Tacoma, Washington, and nobody ever heard of such things, and they would not accept it. So the judges wouldn't give it up. Therefore, no prize was given at all that year.
For goodness sake.
That was one thing. Well, then Dodd and Mead took it, and they very reluctantly did a very small edition, which sold out in 2 weeks. And they had knocked down the type they put it in, because no new author ever sells more than 300 copies. And I also was under contract to them for My Mother Bids Me Bind My Hair. And they printed a few more of those, but they were both best sellers as far as they went, you see. And I have made through those novels many great friends, and one of them is August Derleth. I know he won't mind my saying so. He said, "This is a memorable and major novel. I wouldn't give it up." Stuart Holbrook told me the same thing.
Oh, isn't that wonderful? Mm-hmm. Both of those, of course, are very great men and great writers, too. Well, every author has bad periods of waiting and anticipating and dreading and hoping.
The tragic part of it is that they will take something that turns out to be pretty good, and will not take it, I mean, and then they will take something that is utterly worthless and put a lot of money in it. And I've known that to happen. A funny little incident about recitation from memory. Of course, it's based on my family's experience in early Tacoma. And my father is the letter carrier, and his brother's the letter carrier, and we go through, and all the characters that are my family are pretty true to life. But being a natural-born liar and fiction writer, it was impossible for me, when I came to a real good situation where I could dramatize it and bring in somebody that was interesting, of course I did it. Well, one of the characters in the book that is most beloved by everybody is Skookum the Linden Boy. And when people find out that Skookum was a fictionized character, they want to murder me. And one woman said, "I will never go to Tacoma again because there's no Skookum." And my niece, well, she was just about ready to knock my head off when she found there was no Skookum. She couldn't believe it.
Well, that's a
so
shame.
Really, I did create, and I created a character that lives.
Yes, indeed. It lives for many of us who have read it and who have reread your novels. Anyone who lives in Tacoma certainly ought to be familiar with Elizabeth Sale's Mother Bids Me Bind My Hair and Recitation from Memory. I just wish that there were more of them. Fenella could have gone on forever.
Well, but you see, Dodd Mead wouldn't take any more of the books, didn't want any more books about that family for some reason or other. And, but I have thought sometime of writing a third one, and writing it in reminiscence when Fenella is an old lady, not as old as I am, but pretty near, and she can go back then and tell what happened after she married Malcolm Wallace.
Uh-huh. Well, Miss Sale, thank you very, very much for coming and sharing your poetry with us and for talking with us and for letting us record you so that we might have you available for people to know for many, many years and to hear here in Tacoma. Sometimes we don't get a chance to hear an author, and I think that's often a mistake.
Well, thank you, Miss Krieger. It certainly has been lovely of you to ask me to do this.
Good evening.